Good morning. It's nice to see you all here. Happy Labor Day weekend. I thought we might start this morning by just sitting. I know some of us have just arrived. And probably have busy hearts and busy minds. So perhaps just 2 or 3 minutes we could just sit and let our life kind of catch up with us. Just find an expression, a posture with your body that's comfortable and upright. And let go of earlier this morning. And let go of later today. And you can kind of find yourself by finding your body and breath. And we'll just sit for a minute and remind ourselves how it feels to just be alive. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for doing that with me. It's kind of nice, isn't it? Just to do that. It doesn't take long to at least get a hint of that stillness that's underneath all of the noodles. All right, so this morning I'm talking about three different poems from a Chinese Buddhist nun, and one of them is printed on the front of your programs, for those of you who've got a program this morning. The information that I know about her life I got from a beautiful book called Daughters of Emptiness, which is essentially a collection of poems and writings from Chinese Buddhist nuns, and it spans quite a long period of time. And some of these people we know quite a bit about, some of them we know almost nothing about. But these are voices, these are Dharma voices that are authentic and deep and beautiful and really haven't been heard much in many, many centuries. Unless you were fortunate enough to know them and study with them when they were alive, a lot of the stuff wasn't really recorded and passed down the way the voices of some of the male ancestors were. So there's a tremendous amount of depth in Dharma that's coming out right now in this country, and some of us are being able to tap in now because of the information age, right? Being able to tap in and hear some of these voices that have been silent for so long. So we are very fortunate. And these poems are by Xinguang, and if anybody here knows Chinese, you can tell me in 45 minutes how to actually pronounce that name. But that's the pronunciation I'm going with. And what we know about her, the facts, are that she lived from the year 1597 in our calendar to 1654, so 57, 58 years. She showed, I guess what you would call religious inclinations, spiritual inclinations from a very, very early age. These were dissuaded by her parents, as one can imagine. Religious life is not rewarding in the same way that secular lives are rewarding. So, much like the Buddha, they kind of went out of their way to make sure she didn't follow that trail. They forced her to get engaged instead. And at some point during her engagement, her fiancé died. And I didn't write this down in my notes. My memory tells me that she held off on choosing to be ordained as a nun until her parents passed, because I think she had a sense it would cause them grief. So after her parents died, when she was 34, she then joined the Sangha. She ordained. So she practiced from age 34. She studied under two very famous and very well-known Zen masters of the age. I don't know their names. And then she did a one-decade solitary retreat. That's a long retreat. I know long is, you know, relative, but a long solitary retreat, 10 years. And after she did a decade of retreat, she was actually asked to become the abbess of a monastery called Crouching Lion. All those Chinese monasteries always have really cool names, don't you think? I just think that's a really cool name. So what we know is that she was very charismatic. She was a very eloquent and gifted Dharma teacher. She had lots of devoted students. She left 7 female Dharma heirs when she died. She had lots of both lay disciples and ordained disciples. And when she died at 57, really all that was left was this very small collection of some of her recorded poems and sayings, which were subsequently recorded and translated, as I said recently, in this book, Daughters of Emptiness. So I'm just going to touch a little bit on 3 of these short poems. And my basic theme today, the takeaway, is that there's a lot to these writings. And I encourage you to spend time with them on your own. See what's in there for you. I'm just giving you my thoughts, my reactions to these poems. But there's a tremendous amount that's going on in these poems. And, you know, the facts of her life that we all just learned are just the facts. But they're not really the heart. You know, they're not really the Dharma of this person. And, you know, she was generous in that she left us this gift. And we're fortunate to have what she did write. So I just encourage you to, you know, spend some time with the poem on your program. Look up the other stuff online. Check it out in a book, you know, from our library or from somewhere else. Because Dharma is one of those things that, you know, is only alive for you when it's alive for you. Does that make sense? Right? And she's teaching. I mean, this isn't dusty old words from a long time ago from somebody who's long dead. This is happening right now. You know, she's teaching. She's teaching you right now, and it's for you. I'm not a conduit. This is direct from her to you. So that's kind of what I'm hoping, is you get just enough of a flavor from what I say that you go, oh, wow, I'm going to go check that out. And you can spend some time with her. She's very cool, and I know exactly what I've just told you about her, but I also know what comes up in my body of feeling when I read her poems, and I feel like, oh, she's an intimate friend. So there are 3 poems, the longest of which is on your program. The other 2 are very short. They're only 4 lines. So I'll just read them to you. And the first is called The Alms Bowl. I actually don't know if she would have given these titles to the poems or if the title would have been given by the translator, just for ease. I'm not sure actually how that works. But the title that was given to it is The Alms Bowl. And it's short, 4 lines. She says, "How very elegant it is, with not even a single leak or hole. When thirsty, I drink. When hungry, I eat, leaving not a crumb. I understand that once washed, nothing more need be done. Yet how many lost souls insist on attaching a handle to it." Isn't that nice? I'll read it again. "How very elegant it is, with not even a single leak or hole. When thirsty, I drink. When hungry, I eat, leaving not a crumb. I understand that once washed, nothing more need be done. Yet how many lost souls insist on attaching a handle to it." So that's the alms bowl. And so the alms bowl in the poem represents an alms bowl. But we'll have some fun and play with images and pretend that these are metaphors. We can certainly see that she's using this as a metaphor for life, for our lives. As many of you know, in traditional in traditional Buddhist communities, the alms bowl was one of the things you were given when you were ordained. You're given a robe, a bowl, and a razor, I think. You know, won't shave your head, you've got your food there in the bowl and the robe. That's what you have. You relinquish every other thing. So the bowl is what you carry with you when you go once a day on your alms round. You go into town and you go from door to door and you offer, you know, you hold up your bowl and they put food in your bowl and you, that's what you eat. So that's it. This is her alms bowl. So it's her begging bowl, and the tradition is to take what's offered. The tradition further says you eat what is offered. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm very, very accustomed, being a 21st century person who lives in North America, to having a lot of choices when it comes to what I eat. I therefore have lots of preferences about what I choose to eat. So to go from door to door and just say, you put in whatever you want, and I will accept it and I will eat it, would be really difficult practice for me. I'd have lots of stories about who you were based on what you put in my bowl. Ooh, nice lady. Ooh, not nice lady. Right? You know. So this is, you can see why they did this. This is deep practice. You'd really see your preferences fast, wouldn't you? And it's more than, this isn't just something I get to look at or listen to or hang out with. I'm putting it in my body and it becomes me. This is pretty intimate, right? Eating? Incredibly intimate. I'm choosing what's going to become my body. I'm choosing what's going to make the cells of my brain. I'm doing it right now. In it goes. Wow. And I'll take whatever you give me. Wow. Very deep practice. So she is willing, the alms bowl is willing to accept, contain anything offered. And I put it to you that we really aren't any different. Our lives really aren't any different. We ultimately don't have a choice but to accept the nature of our lives, the contents of our lives. And I know most of you know we spend a huge amount of time trying to say no to that and yes to this and more of this and less of this. And we have loads of preferences. I mean, I get that, and I know you guys get that. But we also know how our attachment to all those preferences cause us suffering. How much difficulty we create for ourselves. How much difficulty we create for others by saying, I don't want that in my bowl. I want more of that over there. And we essentially do this all the time. Right? We do this all the time. So it's the nature of our mind. We're not, you know, dim-witted. We're not slow. You don't need to add judgment to it. It's what humans do. They pick and they choose. But when our starting point is the elegance, and that's an interesting word there, how very elegant it is to just accept what's offered. Not a single leak or hole. And we can say that about your life too, right? Your life does not have a leak. Your life does not have a hole. There's nothing extra. Right? Your life has nothing extra. Right? Nothing lacking, nothing extra. Elegant and complete. It's just whole. It's round, just the way it is. So Zen practice, so much of what we do here is just about recognizing in our own hearts and minds our desire to, you know, protect our experience, to control our experience of what goes in our bowl, what goes in our life, you know. We put so much energy into that, and we start to recognize that pattern, and then we spend time doing meditation to just practice putting that desire down. From time to time, for just 20 minutes or half an hour, right? And we notice our stuff come up, right? And we just let it go, come back to just eating what's in the bowl. This is what life's giving me right now. Pain in left knee, lower back, cranky, thinking about the state fair, bored. Oh, okay, that's what's in your bowl right now, right? Left knee, lower back, state fair, bored. Can you just eat it? That's it. That's what's coming up. It's not bad. Okay. You know? It's so simple, right? You know, our lives are so, they're so elegant, actually, aren't they? They really don't have a leak or a hole. It's hard, for most of us anyway, it's much harder to see this quality in ourselves. Most of us don't, at least most people I know, don't walk around going, boy, my life is quite elegant. Isn't it? This is quite amazing. If we're lucky, we sort of see other people's lives that way, and oftentimes those we love. You know, we sort of see through the lens of love, and we go, oh, look how whole they are, how elegant they are. And they're doing something like taking out the garbage, right? Or they're making a phone call, or they're peeling carrots, and you just look at them and say, wow, there's nothing missing. There's absolutely nothing missing. And they're in the middle of being anxious about something or scattered about something, and you don't see a problem at all. And you kind of want to say to them, like, I know you're, like, anxious and troubled right now, and that's fine, but that doesn't change anything about who you actually are, because I see. Look at you. Wow. There it is. Elegant. Lacking nothing. You're not leaking. You're not losing. Everything's fine. And, of course, you can't tell them that. Maybe you try. If you're like me, you try, and it doesn't work, and you think, I shouldn't try. And then you do it again. But anyway. So it's a beautiful place to start. And she also mentions leaving not a crumb. And that's hard for us, too. That's, again, about our preference. There is so much that arrives in our lives that we do not want. So we usually do, I ignore it. And I ignore it doesn't work all that well, all that often. So then we try to push it away. And if that doesn't work, then we try to change it. That's usually the sequence, although I'm sure you have your own variations. We all do. We can even try to kill it. In our own way. Try to kill whatever that thing is that comes in. We just don't want the Brussels sprouts in our bowl. We don't want the broken relationship in our bowl. We don't want the getting fired, the experience of being fired. We don't want that in the bowl. There's just too much there we don't want. So this, what I'm saying is, I'm not offering, and I don't believe that she's offering this, as an ideal to which to compare yourself. When something arrives in your life and you don't want it there, okay, just acknowledge that that's in your bowl. That not wanting it is in your bowl. Okay. Does that make sense? Like, I really don't want this to be here. Yeah, I know. Can you be okay with not wanting it to be there? And if the answer is no, can you be okay with not wanting it to know? It seems a little silly, actually. But it's not. It's really not a mind trick. It's really, we know that the door to intimacy, to contentment, to any kind of okayness with what's happening is acceptance. It has to be. It has to be. So where can I start with the acceptance? And even if it's accepting the fact that I can't accept, that I can't accept, that I can't accept, fine. There's your door. You know, you're much closer than you think. That's actually quite intimate. I'm really intimate with my not accepting of this. Okay, how does that feel? So the practice that we do here, Zen Buddhism, and I think kind of this applies to all true spiritual practice, religious practice, is something, a container that has to include everything. I'm actually really adamant about that. I understand that picking and choosing has its place, and there are times when we are able to do that, and there are times when it serves us very well to pick and choose. But we really have to acknowledge we have such limited control. We have such limited control over the circumstances of our lives. And if we can't, at some level, touch a general acceptance of existence, of life itself, we're going to be fundamentally discontent. We can't possibly actually find contentment by trying to arrange all the circumstances, all the people, all the events. It's impossible. It just can't be done. So including everything when we're on the cushion in Zen means including feelings, including thoughts, including tiredness, ideas about those we love, ideas about those we don't love, things we like, things we don't like. Basically practicing being this container that accepts everything, that just holds everything that shows up, you know, including, as I said, our unwillingness to be with what shows up. So I really think that's of paramount importance. Paramount importance. Everything belongs. Everything belongs. And it's very simple, and I know you guys get it, but boy, you also know it's really tough practice. Really, it's tough practice. So she moves on to talk about understanding that once washed, nothing more need be done. This is one way of talking about what we do in Zazen. When we let go of all of our clutter, we're kind of cleaning the place out, right? Does anybody else here look at Zazen as kind of housekeeping? Kind of? It has that sort of feeling like, oh yeah, there's a bunch of, oh yeah, that was cleverly arranged. Whatever, okay, so normal. All right, everybody out. Out. I know you're going to rush back in again, but right now, out, you kids, and don't slam the door. That was my mom for a minute. So just washing the bowl, so simple, so challenging for us. Once washed, nothing more need be done. Isn't that interesting? Nothing more need be done. Wow. That almost feels like a statement of faith. It's hard to trust that, isn't it? It's really hard to trust that. The fundamental okayness of that bowl. Just wash it. That's all you need to do. It's not too small. It's not too big. It's not the wrong color. It's not lacking something. It doesn't need a fancy design. The design it has is fine. Really hard to trust that about our lives. So hard to trust that about our lives. So Zen practice is about not adding a handle. She says, how many lost souls insist on attaching a handle to it? And I'm sure that applies to, 7 billion people now on the planet? So you're not alone. When you find yourself attaching a handle, just know, yes, this is what humans do. Right? My bowl, I'm positive it'll be better if I attach a handle. It'll be a really cool handle. It'll have a nice arc. Yes. We do it, and we notice it, and we let it go, and the handle falls off, and we do it. Oh, there it is again, and we notice it, and we let go. Right? The cool thing is to notice how perfect it is without anything added. How inherently okay the bowl is. How inherently okay the life is. Already round. Already full. And I like the term lost soul because how many of us, that's a very evocative feeling phrase. How many of us feel that way when you're trying to find the right design, the right handle, the right ingredient, the right, get the stuff out you don't want, get in the stuff you do. If I could just, and there's something almost frantic about that sometimes. Don't you think? I just know reality is broken. I just know it's fundamentally broken. If I could just, and there's such a constriction around that. So, it's elegant. And when she reminds us it's elegant, she juxtaposes it with this. We attach a handle. When we do that, we lose ourselves. We become lost souls. It's a wonderful teaching there. And I'm sure there's much more. As I said, there's much more to all of these. So, look the poem up and find it and see what else comes to you. This would be a good little verse to put over your kitchen sink. So when you're doing dishes, you could read it. I'm just throwing it out there. All right. So the next poem is the one that's on the cover of your programs. This is a little bit longer, and it's been given the title Behind Closed Doors. I will read it aloud for those of you who do not have a program. Behind Closed Doors. After teaching and preaching, running about for so many years, now I have shut my door and retired to the hidden forest spring. Having kicked open heaven and earth, I can now rest my feet. Alone, I sit before the winter window, the shimmering moon full. Spending the day in a foolish way, no need for any method. Here within, there is neither existence nor non-existence. Straight and tall, I sit, cutting off the path of sage and fool. Since time immemorial, to the present day, it has been so. So that's Behind Closed Doors. And it's a beautiful poem to me. It strikes me as just gorgeous. It feels to me like something very wise and very gentle and very tender. And it makes me think that it's kind of like something she would have written maybe later in her life toward the end. Because she's already starting to look back, having kicked open heaven and earth, I can finally rest. I imagine that she wrote this after she was done being the abbess of the monastery. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I imagine. And it's a little bit like a poem written to herself. you know, a poem of appreciation of the life that she's been fortunate enough to live and create. And looking back on her life, she has this warm feeling. And it occurred to me, as I was getting ready for this talk, I thought, you know, that would be a neat exercise for all of us to do, wouldn't it? If someone gave us an assignment, please write an 8-line poem of appreciation for your life. Could you just do that? And they're like, oh, that would probably be interesting for us, wouldn't it? How would that look? How would you write, what would that sound like, a poem of appreciation? For just the arc of your life, if you were done tomorrow and you were looking back on the whole thing, how would that poem sound? So maybe do that. Maybe put that above your sink. I don't know. I'm just making this stuff up. But when I read it, I really feel proud of her. That's just the feeling that arises. I just go, oh, I'm so proud of you. Thank you. I want to bow to her and thank her for her life of practice. I want to thank her for kicking open the doors of heaven and earth. That's what we do at Zen Center. That's what we're here to do. That's what we do. We kick open the doors of heaven and earth. Every time we sit, we kick open the doors of heaven and earth. That's a dramatic way of putting it, but it's true. That's what we do. I know it doesn't sometimes feel that way. Sometimes it feels like just making yourself come back to really boring, mundane, what did I say, left knee, back, state fair board. That's kicking open the doors of heaven and earth. I promise it is. So when she's looking back on her life of having done that, it's almost like, what more is there to do? I mean, she's kind of, don't you think? Kind of, there's a word I want to use and I won't use, but, you know, she's hardcore. There, I can say that. She's hardcore. I kick open the doors of heaven and earth. Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. Your whole life kicked open the doors of heaven and earth. Everybody's life does that. And now she can rest. And, of course, resting and kicking open the doors of heaven and earth are the same thing. Aren't they? Same thing. Same thing. And what she's left with after kicking open the doors of heaven and earth is nothing but the moon, the shimmering full moon sitting there in the sky. Isn't that cool? That's her takeaway, which through one lens is nothing. You got nothing. At the end of your long life, all your famous students, you were the abbess of monastery, all the worldly titles, blah, 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 blah. What do you have? The moon. Well, I had that to start with. Yeah, you did. That's interesting. There it is. It's not even yours. Oh, but it is. It's rising just for you. So, as a lot of you I know this, Zen oftentimes uses the symbol of the moon. The moon is a representative of enlightenment. So she can just rest there, as she described, sitting at her window with her beautiful still mind. And that soft, you know, moonlight has that kind of soft gaze. Doesn't it? It's different than sunlight. It has that kind of soft gaze that falls on everything and takes in everything, and it accepts everything, and it remembers everything. And so everything is just kind of bathed in this awareness. You know, the awareness that we cultivate on the cushion of just accepting. Yeah, now it's the knee and the back and the state fair, and then it's a memory, and then it's a fear. And then it's, joy. Right? The light of your awareness falls on everything. It just falls. It doesn't care. It doesn't discriminate. It just holds all of it. That's what she has. So she has everything. And this is a wonderful metaphor. The Buddha Dharma does not make distinctions. It does not make distinctions. It just doesn't. It's incapable of making distinctions. It's just a seamless whole, you know, right? Just like your life. It's a seamless whole. No extra handle, no leaks or holes. So she's just resting, and that's always the invitation in our meditation practice in our lives, is to return to our inherent simplicity, our inherent resting, the stillness of the mind that is always there. You know, we're never apart from it. And I love that she says, she uses the word foolish. Spending the day in a foolish way, no need for any method. Here within, there is neither existence nor non-existence. Boy, that sounds almost Dogen-y, actually, especially kicking out the method. And spending the day in a foolish way. She's foolish now. Isn't that? I think that's kind of cool. And, you know, sometimes we joke here that we joke about sitting zazen as being very foolish. It's a tremendously foolish thing to do, don't you think? Talk about unproductive. Even when you find yourself working on something in your mind, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm really going to do nothing. This is the stupidest possible thing I can do. And I even let go of my ideas about it being stupid because that makes it too smart. Wow. I really like that. Tim says, keep it foolish. Keep it stupid. He says that a lot. And I like, well, it appeals to me anyway. If this was clever, you guys, I would not be here. So there's our invitation she's giving us. Just let it be foolish. Let it be simple. Right? Because what she's talking about is trusting, right? Just something simple and trusting. Simple and trusting. I mean, in a sense, during Zazen, when you have your plan and your idea and your agenda about your universe, right? Your map of the universe, and you choose to let it go and come back, that's a huge expression, actually, of kind of inherent faith. Living must be okay. The next moment must be about to arise. I don't know what I'm returning to. I have no idea. I mean, I know we oftentimes think we know, but we don't. We have no idea. So letting go of the map and returning to what's raw, what's right there, yeah, incredibly simple. But sort of foolish that there is no map. I can't possibly be clever about life because it's always changing. It's impossible to know anything. Really, right? So that's cool, right? We can pick up the map when Zazen's done. It's useful, sure. But, you know, practice always reminds us the thing you have on the paper is not the landscape. That's the metaphor they use, right? That's just a map. It's wrong, half right, three-quarters right, 80% right, I don't know. Keeping it simple, keeping it stupid, keeping it foolish seems very honest to me. It's kind of the way you played when you were like three. Foolish and not even caring. No sense of foolish. Just, ugh. Oh, and now she can fly. Oh, and then the donkey comes. You know? Right? It's just, here it is. I don't know where this is going. Why am I doing this? I don't know. I mean, it never occurs to you to ask a three-year-old, why are you playing? Like, what? When will you be done? What? What are you trying to get? What? Like, those aren't relevant questions. It ends when it ends, and it is because it is, and that's it. And that's, of course, what our what our lives are. And I know we add, oh, it'll be over when we, and I'll feel better when I. And it makes sense because I. And the meaning is blah, blah, blah. No, 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 no. Because we're adults. We're very clever. So we have all those. And that's fine, too. But really, it's like, no, no, it's way simpler than that. It's like super, super foolish. Poof. So, no method, no technique. It's very Zazen. It's very Zazen. Think non-thinking, returning to just what is. There's nothing we're trying to wring out of existence to get on the cushion. There's no way of knowing at the end of your 40-minute sitting, did you do it well? Did you do it poorly? There's no way of knowing it. There's no metric. You know, there's nothing you're trying to get there. And if you do try to get something, fine. That's fine, too. But you know what I mean? It's that simple. There's no way of getting anything. So no existence, she says, no non-existence, no sage, no fool. I love that because she's a sage, right? You're the abbess of a monastery. I mean, if anybody gets the right to wear the big goofy mitre hat and be wise woman on the hill, you are actually literally that. She's like, pfft. No sage, no fool. Throw it all out. No wise, lofty spiritual stuff, which also means no boring, mundane, common, sinful stuff either. You guys know that, right? Zen's really big on throwing out the whole idea of there being sacred and mundane or holy and sinful or whatever. Throwing out that split. We see how much suffering that causes us. So no boundaries. No boundaries. No existence, no non-existence. No holy, no mundane. No boundary. And then her last line, since time immemorial to the present, it has always been so. It's cool. It's not like I created it. I invented it. No, it's always been this way. This is the nature of everything. It's always been this way, right? She's just discovering, has discovered for herself what has always been discovered, what already is. And the only other thing I'll add to that is that when she says, since time immemorial to the present, it has always been so, well, she wrote that in, let's say, 1562. But that's not the present she's talking about. It's right here. It really is the breath you are taking right now. Since time immemorial to the breath you're taking right now. It has always been so. You're included in this. You are included. So it's the right now moment that you are, that has no boundaries. And the right now moment that you are, that has no boundaries, is fully illuminated. Fully illuminated. So, that's as much as I want to say about that one. There's a lot more to it. It's a lovely poem. And I'm especially fond of the kicking open heaven and earth. Man, that really worked for me. Okay, so our last one today. And then we'll be done. The last one, again, is short. It's four lines. And this one will be familiar to at least some of you here. Ben actually talked about this. Ben talked about this, I want to say a year or so ago, but I'm terrible with time. So he talked about this. Maybe it was during a retreat. I don't know. Anyway, in my mind, it's a famous poem because it's existed for a year. In my head. So I'm like, oh, yes, this is very well known. Very, very famous. And, of course, you know, that is your version is the version of every, you know. So anyway, I'll read it to you. It's called The Meditation Cushion. A single meditation cushion, and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the great universe assembles on the tip of a feather. Actually, I'll read that again. The meditation cushion. A single meditation cushion, and one is completely protected. Earth may crumble, heaven collapse, but here one is at peace. Sacred titles and worldly fame both fade away in the sitting, and the great universe assembles itself on the tip of a feather. So this is, again, a very evocative collection of images that are very clearly about meditation. That's what she's talking about, very obviously. And it's an expression, of course, as our zazen, of our zazen as refuge. You know, we talk so much about refuge in Buddhism, the refuges. Take refuge in Buddha, take refuge in Dharma, take refuge in Sangha. Sitting practice itself, meditation itself, embodied Buddha itself, zazen itself as refuge, as safety and comfort. And this is, to use Katagiri Roshi's words, this is spiritual security as defined by our ability to be with what is. Right? Our ability to be with what actually is spiritual security in Zen. Right? It isn't an added construct. It isn't a belief system. It isn't da-da-da-da-da. It's not knowing how the universe started or having an idea about how it might end. It's, can I be with this? Can I be with this? Right? Because it's changing all the time. It makes sense, actually. I was like, that's actually the deepest sense of security there would be. You know, the wallet will never stay in my back right pocket. Someday it will not be there. If I think that's security, it'll work for a while, but someday it won't. If security is health, someday that'll go away. If security is youth, that'll go away. If security is my wife, that's going to go away. My family, my job, my titles, my ideas, they're all going to go away. They have to. It's the nature of the universe. Wow, my ability to be with what is, that's something else. And that is what zazen is. So it's fascinating. This is one of the things, Ben, that I remember him exploring in his talk was zazen is a fascinating paradox, and of course it isn't a paradox, but you know, we simplify things and it appears to be two different things. Zazen is complete refuge, total safety, and complete exposure at the very same time. Right? Because you're willing to be with what is. What if what comes up is your lust, your anger, your hate, your prejudice? That's what's coming up. It doesn't make you feel very good. You are completely exposed to it. And you've committed yourself for the length of that sitting to see it. You don't get to lie to yourself. You don't get to turn on your computer. You don't get to turn on the radio and tell yourself, no, I'm really super awesome. Or whatever, right? No, you get to see it and go, oh, there it is. You're completely naked, right? On the cushion, no props, no toys, Nothing. No music even playing in the background. You guys have done zazen here, you know. It's like, oh, man, give me at least some of that nice flute music. Something, you know. I just want a toy. It's so naked. We're so exposed and at the same time completely safe. Earth may crumble and heaven collapse, but here we are at peace. So this is going back to that same idea. When do we find peace in our lives? It's not when everything is perfect. We find it right in the middle of heaven crumbling and earth collapsing because we can't find it any other place. So this poem of hers, this meditation cushion poem, is a expression of the peace that she has found through self-relinquishment, I guess you could say. Right? All of her ideas, all of her preferences about what she wants in the bowl and what she doesn't, when you let them all go and you can just be okay with what is, there's just complete contentment. You just don't want anything to be different. So, even when worldly fame goes away, sacred titles, they go away. It's okay. And when everything fades away, when self is totally emptied, and the last line, you know, both fade away, worldly titles, sacred titles, worldly fame fade away, what's left? Her last line, the great universe assembles itself on the tip of a feather. That's what we find. Isn't that weird? You would think the opposite. When I give up everything about me, I'm just going to find bereftness and emptiness and hopelessness and sadness and there'll be no... And instead it's everything. She finds every single thing there is when she's not in the way, right? The whole universe itself, assembling itself on the tip of a feather in the most mundane object. In the most mundane object, all of reality balanced. It's incredibly important that she uses the word, or that the word is translated as assembles itself. She didn't do the assembling. You're not doing the assembling. It's already assembled. It takes care of itself. All she's done is relinquish her desire to control it, her desire to have it be different, her grasping, right? The whole universe just assembled itself from the tip of a feather. She had nothing to do with it. And yet, she had everything to do with it. Isn't that wonderful? And of course, this isn't a special thing. This is nothing special, as we talked about yesterday when Norman Fisher was here. This isn't a special moment. This isn't happening later. This doesn't happen down the road after you've done a 10-year retreat. This isn't something that occurs to you if you become the abbess of a great monastery called Crouching Lion. It's assembling itself on the tip of a feather right now. There is only one moment in which to practice. There is only one breath you can take. It's this one. Right? This isn't later. This is happening right now. It is what you are. It is what reality is. Right? How could it be otherwise? So, reality is just happening. You are that. It can't not happen. So all of this is just an expression of the awareness, this insight that's developed in our practice. But it's not that it's not already happening. It is already happening. We just begin to see it more and more clearly. So, to finish today, I'll kind of repeat myself. I want to encourage you to do Zen practice, of course, if you don't. That's obvious. But I want to encourage you to spend some time with Zingang. She is very beautiful, and these words are very wise. And as I said, she is not through teaching. She is teaching you right now. She is teaching us right now. And I encourage you to interact with her. I encourage you to work with her words. I encourage you to question her, doubt her, pull those words apart, put them back together again. That's what Buddhism is, you know, inquire very deeply. Don't just trust it, just pull it apart for yourself. Is it true? Is it true? Question her. Spend some time with her. And of course, you're questioning yourself. And maybe pick up her questions as your own. And really ask yourself, and not with your head, but ask yourself with your breath, when you're sitting on the cushion, ask with your body, does my life have a leak? I mean, really, does my life have a hole? Can I kick open the doors of heaven and earth? Can you do that? What really is on the tip of a feather? You know, see for yourself what really is there. on the tip of your finger. See it. That's the spirit of inquiry that she had, that she's encouraging us to have for ourselves, so that we can find what she found. And that's as much as I think I want to say today. So thank you very much. We do have a few minutes anyway, about five or so, if anybody has anything they'd like to offer, questions, comments. Kate?
The universe assembles itself on the tip.
Mm-hmm.
It has no more weight than it's important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The whole universe, and then
isn't it awesome? Yeah. Because there's a bunch of things she could have said.
Yeah.
And they all would have worked, but that's such an evocative, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't it? She is hardcore.
She is hardcore.
Yeah.
She's badass.
That's the word I was not... Yeah. I'm glad you liked it. Yes. What else today? Please.
I was struck by you by the word kicked open heaven and earth.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk more about what that means to you and how meditation or Zazen does that.
That's a very good question. It's kind of a talk in itself. Well, what will I say about that? I will say, kicking open the doors of heaven and earth. Yeah, boy, I like that. Well, there's a lot of different things we can do with that. And probably the easiest to talk about, the least sort of lofty or abstract, is... because she uses heaven and earth, of course, two different times. In the last poem, heaven may crumble, earth collapse, or vice versa. And then again in the other poem, heaven and earth. This is one of the ways that I look at this is, this is kind of one of the fundamental symbolic representations of the split that we all have. You know, if you were really forced to ask and you're really being honest, you'd say, I live on earth, and then there's this other thing called, and maybe you'd have a different word for it. Maybe it isn't where you go after you die. Maybe it's, if my life were perfect, it would be. You know, if I had all of my ducks in a row, right? But it's the split that we all do between what is and what we want. You know, the perfect version and what actually is. The disappointing, crummy, mundane, what actually is. The great universe assembling itself in the tip of the feather is just not somehow enough for me. It's fundamentally lacking. That's good. It's good, but heaven... I like it because when I think of heaven, you know, because I was raised Catholic, so I have this idea, well, heaven, well, first it happens after you're dead, because it's not ever going to happen here. And then number two, it's a place where everything's perfect. There's no friction, there's no conflict, there's no nothing. I mean, everybody you ever loved is there, nobody that you don't love is not there. I mean, I don't know what, the best music's playing, the best party food, the hors d'oeuvres, I don't know, you get to eat and you never fill up. I don't know, whatever it is for you, I'm just saying. And of course, Buddhism is so... It's in such stark contrast to that. These ideas about how much better things could be than they are what get in my way. And I think of kicking open the doors of heaven as like saying, I don't know, for me it's sort of like, no, me too, and not later, now, and not when it's different, this. Right? Christ said, the kingdom of God is spread out upon the earth, but we do not see it. I'm like, yep, there it is. Not later. Not after you die. Not when you've improved it. Right now. Wow. And that's a cool sentence, but seriously, how many people in the history of humanity have seen this is it? Wow. So kicking open the doors of heaven and earth. Wow, it just seems like breaking down any distinction that I make between the secular and the sacred, or the holy and the mundane, or the people that I love and the people that I don't love. Wow. Incredibly challenging. I just see it as a metaphor for that. We might be able to make an assumption that she's referring to an actual experience of awakening, of something of going, I get it. I do see. You know, when you see that the kingdom of God is spread out upon the earth, there's nothing more to look for. Right, the doors are broken. There's no barrier anymore. There's no separate heaven and earth. Here it is. It's one unified totality. That's kind of the way I see it, but that's a great question because, again, it's a dramatic, kind of evocative, poetic image. I mean, I don't know, Buddhism is sort of interesting and then it's like sort of saying like everybody gets to come to the table. It doesn't include, it doesn't exclude anybody. So it isn't for the special, it isn't for the da-da-da-da. You get to kick open the doors. That's the good news. The bad news is you're the one who has to kick open the doors. Right? No one else gets to do it for you. You get to do it. But please do. Please do. There's loads of space. It's fabulous. And it's also right now. So, I don't know. Is that a good answer? I'm looking for heaven. Thank you.
Maybe it's saying, why do we attach to these words?
Yeah, they don't represent any actual reality. You know, yeah.
In this context.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, maybe because, of course, I always think of, you know, heaven as being up. We were talking about this yesterday, actually, with Katagiri. Norman Fisher was saying that Katagiri is quoted as saying, when I'm really feeling caught by my anger, by an afflictive emotion, I look up. And seeing the sky helps me, makes me feel space. That makes sense to me. I think we instinctively look up to get a sense of space. Or when your life feels really turbulent and nothing works and everything's broken, and you look at the night sky and go, it looks like everything's doing just fine. There's really nothing wrong up there. It's just sort of reality check in a way, or maybe perspective. But I don't remember how old I was, but at some point I realized that the sky goes all the way down to this. I don't know why that was a big moment for me, but I was like, the sky is up there. And that's where everything's, I don't know, birds and clouds and it's pretty, and maybe heaven or maybe grandma and grandpa live up there or something. It's sky. And then there's, but at some point I realized there's not a gap. Actually, sky goes into my lungs when I breathe. I was, oh my God. Like there's nothing between me and the stars, really. Air isn't between us. And I just went, oh my goodness. So I kind of see it just like you're saying, like there's breaking open the doors of heaven and earth. Well, yeah, they're there if you want them to be, but it's not like there's a door. It's just right there. So there's a lot to this stuff, isn't there? Ooh, she's good. She's good. I hope you guys spend time with her. Real quick, yeah.
I'm struggling a little bit with trying to reconcile the idea of acceptance with the sort of bold action it seems to take to break open the doors or to even like be here on a cushion, right?
Yeah.
Everybody in this room decided this is a good way to spend a Sunday morning. We could also accept that, oh, this Sunday morning I'm just going to sleep instead of going to sit on a cushion or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So, like, acceptance doesn't seem to mean without action. And I'm just struggling to, I don't know, I'm struggling to understand how you put those things together.
Oh, that's a fabulous question. Thank you. It's a very fabulous question. I can only, because I know we have to go, I can only very briefly touch on it. That's one of the fundamental questions. We spend a lot of time with that on Soto Zen because, you know, we have this idea of fundamental inherent enlightenment. Ta-da! Here it is. Perfect. There's your life. You're Buddha. Great. Which, of course, automatically gives rise to the question, well, then why would I ever do anything? I mean, I might as well sleep in. I'm just as enlightened asleep as I am awake sitting here in this weird posture with my knees hurting, so clearly the at-home asleep version of Buddha is better than the, you know. That's a guess. Oh, there's so many ways of talking.